It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, we present our year in review, a look at many of the top stories of 2019, and a look ahead at 2020. Coming up later, we'll explore major stories that evolved this year in health, education, criminal justice, and the arts. But first, it's been a year of incremental change for the Pittsburgh region. Changes to local leadership and later the midterms, plus the promise of new development and updates to long-awaited projects. We're joined in studio by WESA Government Accountability Editor Chris Potter, as well as Transportation and Development Reporter Margaret J. Krause. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Chris, there was a major party shakeup in the U.S. House at the beginning of this year. Looking back, what impact do you think changes to Pennsylvania's delegation had at the federal level?
Yeah, that's right. So we went from a situation where this was, although a purple state, this had formerly been a place where Republicans dominated the congressional delegation. And then the state Supreme Court basically said, this map doesn't work. It's not really reflective. It's gerrymandered. And so now we have, as a result of those changes, a delegation that is split between Democrats and Republicans. And of course, that was part of a broader national change where Democrats are now the majority party in the House, as some of you may have seen watching television last night. So I think clearly the fact that Democrats were able to take control of the House this year changed. Obviously, we wouldn't have had an impeachment proceeding last night. And a lot of the other sort of watchdog functions that the House is playing would not be being played right now.
Still 4 months until the Pennsylvania primary, but yeah. Presidential candidates have made several trips to the Pittsburgh region. Some of those candidates are no longer in the race. What have you been looking for or listening for as both Democrats and members of the Trump administration have made their way here?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, one of the big issues, maybe the biggest issue that's specific to this region is natural gas drilling and the politics of that. Donald Trump himself has come to the region twice in just the past few months. Both times, his visits were tied to the natural gas industry. He went to the cracker plant under construction in Beaver County. And of course, he came to a convention of natural gas executives in the city itself. We have seen at the federal level and at the local level how natural gas drilling is sort of dividing the Democratic base. You've seen Mayor Peduto take issue with the petrochemical industry, and much divisiveness ensued. But it's also an issue that's been tough for Republicans and some local issues too. So that I think has been the big issue that I've been paying attention to and expect to continue to do.
Are there similar messages here as well as maybe in other swing states early on, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Florida?
Yeah, I mean, I think the gas one is not right, not right. Applicable to those. But I do think one issue that is common to a lot of the areas you just mentioned is how the president's trade approach to trade policy is playing out, especially for the manufacturing sector, who he made a very explicit pitch to every time he came to Western Pennsylvania in 2016 and to those other states as well. So it's a real question here. He has taken a hardline stance with respect to China and even some of our trading partners. It has had mixed results. For employers here and in other parts of the country. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
What particularly will you be looking for as the race heats up in 2020?
I think I'll be looking for those two things. And then I also will just be very interested to see how Democrats sort out this still very large field here, what direction they want to go. Do they decide the way to take on Donald Trump is to mobilize their base with a progressive, or do they decide they still want to try to appeal to more moderate voters, which is the strategy they're going to pursue in November?
Margaret, local leaders are looking to the federal government to move forward on a major transportation proposal. What's the latest on the BRT, the Bus Rapid Transit Project?
I want to write a song for probably all states out there that's called Waiting on the Feds. The region resubmitted its bus rapid transit proposal in August for a small starts grant. They asked for about $99 million, which is roughly half of what the BRT will cost. So they won't know whether or not it was granted until probably late winter, early spring. But there's still a lot to coordinate in terms of who is responsible exactly for where do we put stormwater? How do we coordinate all the utilities? Who's going to pay for mill and overlay to make sure the street can actually be used so that right. The transit is indeed rapid?
Still uncertain as to actually when we might see action on BRT, at least from the federal level. But there's finally some movement on redeveloping the site of the former Civic Arena. What's the deal, at least what we know of it so far?
So As many people know, it has been a long time coming, but the Pittsburgh Penguins development arms bought two of the parcels that they will begin development on probably this fall. The first phase of residential construction is expected to begin this fall. Then there's also plans for an entertainment center where there will be a new EMS station moved to and all sorts of sort of attendant developments.
Right. The Lower Hill District community has argued for years now that their voices weren't being heard. Has that changed? How is the plan being received?
It was interesting to watch the URA, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, change its approach to public comment and public feedback. I would say in the last 2 years, there has been a lot more attention paid to a plurality of voices as opposed to this is what we're going to do and here's how it will benefit you. Instead, they're trying to listen to, it seems, what are you thinking will benefit you and how do we ensure that this development does that over the many years it will take to develop it.
And just last week, an anchor was announced for the development.
Yes, First National Bank is committed to being a part of a 24-story tower. It used to be U.S. Steel was going to anchor that in a much different configuration, a lower-rise building, a mid-rise. This is a high-rise. They're going to consolidate their offices here into that headquarters, that anchor.
But so far, these are plans, still just promises a lot of this.
It's hard to overstate how many steps there are in the development process, particularly one as important as the Lower Hill development. So the parcels have been brought, they've been bought. There is this, they can move forward on financing and locking down who's going to be there and how and where the money flows. But each part of the plan still has to move through a public process. So there's still a lot of room to both improve on the existing deals or fall short.
We're talking to Margaret J. Krause and Chris Potter in our Year in Review special on the Confluence. One thing you've both been following again for years now is the One Pittsburgh proposal promised by Mayor Bill Peduto's first successful bid for office. What's the latest? Any signs we might ever get a glimpse? Chris.
I mean, there is no latest. There was some talk in the last budget when the mayor formally proposed the city's budget. Oh, I'll have something for you in a few weeks. That was a month or two ago. As far as I could see, there's just no reason to believe that there'll be any progress until we actually see some. And I think this is a thing that's going to be more pressing here. You know, this was the idea of One Pittsburgh was UPMC, Pitt, those big nonprofits were going to contribute to the city to address longstanding needs. And not only has nothing happened, but in the meantime, taxpayers increasingly are on the hook for this. There'll be a second tax hike in the deed transfer tax next year to pay for affordable housing. There was a parks conservancy tax. These are longstanding quality of life issues that were supposed to be addressed by One Pittsburgh. They have not been, and instead, taxpayers are picking up the bill in the meantime.
Several projects in the city and county have been talked about this year. Let's run through a few of them quickly, Margaret. What's the latest on Penn Plaza?
So the site has been graded. It's sitting empty. There was a land swap. Now the parcel is a complete rectangle. The park is going to be rebuilt outside of that Penley Park South, formerly the Penn Plaza, which was home to a number of low-income, moderate-income families. There is still no clear indication of exactly what the park will look like and exactly how much money there will be. And also, it has yet to be determined how tax revenue from that development will flow to help build affordable housing in the area.
And what about the new $2 billion airport terminal?
I'm sure the airport would like us to say it's about $1.1
billion. Okay.
We like to round up. But they are planning to have a microgrid supporting the entire airport online by 2021. That's natural gas and solar. And the terminal itself is likely to be there about the same time, 2021.
And the I-579 CAP project?
For those angry commuters out there, it will be a park eventually. It is going to cover, so there's a connection between the Lower Hill and downtown. That, too, is expected to be completed in fall of 2021.
And the Highland Park Reservoir, it's reopened, yes?
No. So they had to rebuild a parapet wall. The state required new security enhancements because of making sure that the water supply cannot be messed with. I mean, it's like a federal problem if someone messes with the water supply. So deer wandering in, people feeding ducks, no good. So security cameras, they had to rebuild this parapet wall. But the microfiltration plant is back in functioning, and they had to add an ultraviolet treatment to possibly kill other contaminants.
And a new bike pedestrian plan has been unveiled by the city for 2020.
Yeah.
What should we look for?
It has not been unveiled yet. It is not going to be a bike lane on every street. The idea is, how do we ensure good connections, officials say, for cyclists and pedestrians? How do we use streets to their best and highest use? And there are going to be some new facilities. There's this thing called a neighbor way. So streets that are quieter can have more room for pedestrians, slower traffic, better space for cyclists, better road management.
And will any of this in the city be hampered by resources needed to fill that big sinkhole that opened up downtown in late October?
I'm sure every utility would tell you they wish they hadn't had to spend months filling up a big hole downtown. But from what I can tell, it hasn't affected budget lines that much.
Chris, the year ahead could very well be dominated by elections at the federal and state levels, and voters will be casting ballots on new machines. What are they, and will they be in place by the April primary?
Yes, they will, and it's hard to generalize because every county has bought right. different machines. Here in Allegheny County, we have a system where you'll mark your ballot, and it'll be fed into an optical scanner. They will be in place for the primary this spring and, of course, for the general election. There have already been some concerns in other counties to the east relating to a system that Allegheny County did not buy, but I think there's already some trepidation about undertaking a change in sort of voter infrastructure right before a really key, important national election. The other thing that's changing this coming year is there are changes to how the state legislature passed a law changing voter registration, making ballot access easier for folks. The impact of that on our elections, I think, has yet to be seen. I don't know that people are really starting to grapple with the impact that that could have on how elections take place next year.
Quickly, what about city proposals on gun legislation? A lot of talk stemmed from the Tree of Life shooting in October of 2018, but has anything really changed, at least so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's tied up in courts, which I think everybody knew was going to happen. One of the stories of this year, you said at the top of our discussion here, that this has been a gradual change. The city has had some success in being able to pass a sick leave, requiring employers to offer sick leave, but some other bigger issues like guns remained caught up in the courts, and we'll just have to see how that process plays out.
And Margaret, briefly, any other shovel into the ground developments we should keep our eyes on in the year ahead?
Yeah, there's a bunch, particularly heading out toward Homewood. The East End is, you know, developing quite quickly. Lexington Park is going to be something that people can watch for in the coming months.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's transportation and development reporter. Chris Potter leads our government accountability team. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, the lingering effects of the Clairton Coke Works fire and a sigh of relief for many patients following a deal between UPMC and Highmark. A look at the health stories that made news. That's when the Confluence's Year in Review show continues on 90.5 WESA.
Today's programming is supported by the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University, hosting Ready to Run Campaign Training for Women, a one-day nonpartisan skills-building workshop designed to simplify the political process. The day-long conference is Saturday, January 25th at Chatham's Shadyside campus. Details and registration at pcwp.org.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This year, Pittsburgh broke a number of records, albeit none of them for sports accomplishments. 2019 began with the arrival of the hit Broadway show Hamilton, melting the hearts of history and theater lovers. The Catholic diocese grappled with how to deal with the growing number of priests accused of abusing children while consolidating its parishes. A few barges struck Pittsburgh bridges as the city experienced record cold temperatures. The Post-Gazette went through a number of changes, and the union representing writers there ultimately decided to remove its bylines until management listened to its requests. The spotted lantern fly wreaked havoc on backyard gardens. A lot of presidential candidates have come through the region. Medical marijuana had a successful second year, yielding more patient signups and increasing qualifying conditions. And, of course, the alligators. Seven made their way into the city this year, prompting the creation of a bill that requires owners to disclose their exotic pets and take steps to make their homes more safe. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for 2019.
Usually musicians make news for making records, but 2019 saw a few big records broken instead. Ariana Grande made history in February when she became the first artist to land the top three spots on the Hot 100 since the Beatles first did it in 1964.
Breakfast at Tiffany's and bottles of bubbles, girls with tattoos who like getting in trouble.
But perhaps the biggest story of 2019 was that of Lil Nas X, whose infectious single Old Town Road shattered the longest number one streak with 19 weeks in the top spot.
I got the horses in the bag, horse stock is attached, head is matted black, got the boots black to match.
Closer to home, it was a big year for Pittsburgh music as well, as the Common Heart found their way into living rooms nationwide with their appearance on CBS Saturday Morning.
This whole town's built like a little girl's heart.
For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's the Confluence's Year in Review special on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Negotiations between healthcare giants, lawsuits sparked by the opioid crisis, and outbreaks of contagious diseases dominated the health news headlines this year. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
Shortly before a consent decree was to expire in June, after lawsuits and court battles, Highmark and UPMC reached a new 10-year deal. Remind us, why the two had been at odds, putting thousands of patients in a quandary.
Oh, Kevin, it's been a saga. So back in 2012, UPMC said they weren't going to accept Highmark insurance anymore. This was a big deal because a lot of people had Highmark insurance but going to UPMC doctors. And, you know, changing your doctor, especially if you have more complicated health conditions, is a pain in the butt. So less than a week before people were going to lose access for their doctors to their doctors if they had Highmark, the two healthcare giants reached a 10-year agreement.
And of course, the battle began in 2012 because Allegheny Health Network acquired by Highmark, and now UPMC looked upon them as a competitor in the healthcare providing business.
There's these two big healthcare systems, both providing both health insurance and healthcare. And I mean, Western Pennsylvania isn't that big of a market.
Mm-hmm. So what does this deal mean for patients, especially those who have Highmark insurance?
Well, it means that people with Highmark health insurance can keep seeing their UPMC doctors depending on the healthcare plan. I myself, for example, have Highmark insurance, but I don't have UPMC doctors because I have the Community Blues plan. I would have to pay more if I wanted access to UPMC. So just because you have Highmark health insurance doesn't mean you automatically get access to UPMC doctors. You have to take that out with Highmark.
Okay. So now the two can focus on implementing their separate expansion plans that combined are going to cost about $3 billion. Briefly, what is UPMC doing?
Yes, the healthcare wars are not over yet. UPMC is building these three very fancy specialty healthcare facilities. Originally, they were marketed as hospitals, but for state statutory purposes, you can't call something a hospital if it doesn't have an emergency room. But basically, they're very, very fancy facilities of state-of-the-art medical treatment. And then Allegheny Health Network, which is part of Highmark, they're kind of doing the opposite approach, and they're building these neighborhood hospitals, which are these small hospitals where you can get limited health care. But the nice thing is it's like in your neighborhood. So instead of going to all the way downtown Pittsburgh, you can stay in Westmoreland County and be down the street.
And Allegheny Health Network this month just cut the ribbon on a neighborhood hospital in McCandless Crossing.
Yep.
Sarah, this year health officials and the medical examiner announced a sharp drop in fatal opioid overdoses. What's their answer as to why?
Oh, we don't know. Probably naloxone. I bet a lot of it's naloxone. I don't think people are necessarily using less, but I think people are getting smarter about how they're using opioids.
Mm-hmm. In October, Attorney General Josh Shapiro and some of his colleagues across the nation announced a tentative agreement, $48 billion, to settle lawsuits against opioid makers. How might this affect Pennsylvania, which is acknowledged as one of the worst hit states by the opioid crisis?
Well, we would get a lot of money, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And then the formulary of how this money is going to be split between state government and municipal governments is unknown. But hopefully some of this money would help with the devastation that the opioid crisis has caused, which is far reaching from criminal justice to health to employment to economics.
Right. In January, Mon Valley residents who live near U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works were urged to limit their exposure to outdoor air after the fire at the plant damaged two gas dispatcher stations, resulting in releases of the pollutant sulfur dioxide in excess of federal standards. Major concerns, and are they still going on?
I mean, So right after the fire, there was a lot of spikes with sulfur dioxide emissions, and people were complaining about irritation and poor smells, asthma with kids at a local clinic at the Clareton Elementary School, a lot more agitation. It seems to be more under control, but the Clareton Coke Works monitoring that facility, we're still seeing occasional spikes, but it's not as egregious as it was in the first quarter of the year.
In 2019, mm-hmm. We also experienced some disease outbreaks, hepatitis A, measles, MRSA, MRSA. Is there one that was maybe more surprising or concerning to health officials when you spoke to them?
No, I mean, with MRSA, the MRSA was probably the most surprising, the most concerning. Luckily, I don't think anybody, including babies, got very sick. But that's a serious thing to keep an eye on. When it comes to measles, we've been seeing more measles cases both nationally and internationally. But those cases were confined to one family, so that wasn't super concerning. What were the other ones? Hep A. I mean, with the opioid crisis and people sharing needles, it's actually not as bad in Allegheny County as we've seen in Philadelphia and West Virginia.
Okay. We have about 30 seconds mm-hmm. left. Allegheny County looking for a new health director. Why did Karen Hacker leave? And any word on a replacement?
Karen Hacker left for a sweet job at the CDC, and we're still looking for a director. And my understanding from the board is that she big shoes to fill.
Yes. Of course, she left here after several years, mm-hmm. CDC. And you'll be covering her replacement whenever that is named.
Yeah. I inquired this week, and they're not telling me anything. They're still looking.
Okay. Sarah Bowden is the health and science reporter at WESA. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
Next on the program, major efforts in criminal justice reform this year. We hope you'll stay with us. I'm Kevin Gavin. More from the Confluence's Your Interview is coming up on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence Year Interview special on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been a busy year in state government with a lot of talk and some significant action. Joining us on the line from Harrisburg is our Capitol Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
And in studio is WESA reporter Anlee Herring, who covers government accountability. Good morning, Anlee.
Good morning, Kevin.
Katie, let's start with you. An issue that is always brought up but hasn't really gone anywhere until now, raising Pennsylvania's minimum wage. What's the latest?
The Senate has passed a bill that would raise the minimum wage from $7.25, which is the federal minimum, to $9.50 an hour. And so this was seen as a real compromise between, you know, the Democrats who want a $15 an hour minimum wage, most of them, and the Republicans who have often not wanted a minimum wage increase at all. So now it's all up to the House at this point, and we do not know what they're going to do.
An issue that gained a lot of steam after the grand jury report on clergy abuse of children was a change in the statute of limitations. Katie, what are the key provisions of that legislation?
This gets rid of the criminal statute of limitations on sex abuse of minors and really extends the civil statute of limitations. So that's a big one. And there's still an amendment, this was a key component, working its way through the legislature to open up a retroactive window for suits on old cases on which the statute has expired. And so we'll have to see what they do with that. But they have come to an agreement on it. We're expecting them to pass it.
And that proposed amendment is to the Constitution, correct?
Yes, it is. It is.
Victims' rights were on the minds of lawmakers this year, whether it was with the clergy abuse scandal and the victims from that, but also the passage of Marcy's Law, which was approved by voters as a constitutional amendment. Anlee, what will this mean to victims?
Well, the law passed at the ballot box. Voters approved it. It would amend the state constitution if it stands up against a legal challenge, which it's currently tied up with right now. And what it would do is it would add victims' rights to the state constitution. Right now, those rights are in statute, And it includes things like notification of court dates, being allowed to speak at those court proceedings, being able to say that things are going too quickly or that they need to slow down. And it would let victims petition the judge to enforce their interests if the judge believes that is what should happen. Defendants' rights have long been in the Constitution, and victims' advocates say that this would create a level playing field.
And Katie, as Ann Lee mentioned, it's in the courts, even though voters approved of it in November. Why is it in court? Why is it in the courts? Why is it being challenged?
Yeah, so the ACLU has some significant concerns about Marcy's law. They say that it could compromise the rights of people accused of crimes, and it's very complicated and sort of jargony, so I'd urge everybody to read that. But basically, they say it's unconstitutional because it compromises those rights. So now our courts are going to have to decide whether or not that is the case. So as Ann Lee indicated, it's kind of in a limbo right now. People voted for it. It passed overwhelmingly. But now we have to see what the courts decide.
All right. This summer, the legislature ended general assistance welfare payments to some 68,000 people. Katie, who were the recipients of the assistance?
These people are often described as sort of the poorest of the poor. These are people who have very, limited assets, really nothing. And it is supposed to be a supplement to programs like SNAP that give people food. It's so they can buy things like toiletries. It's really just for like basic essentials, and it's not very much money a month. Republicans had wanted to get rid of this for a while. They got rid of it back in, I believe, 2012.
Governor Wolf actually reinstated this general assistance last year, and then he decided to repeal it, right?
It was brought back up this year as part of this larger bill to put funding into state hospitals, specifically hospitals in Philadelphia, actually. And so that was seen as a way to get Governor Wolf to sign it by tying it to other funding. And it worked, and he did, even though he says he wanted to keep general assistance. And actually this week, the courts released an initial decision upholding the repeal of general assistance. We're expecting to see more litigation on it, but for now, that is sort of the state of the playing field.
Ann Lee, state lawmakers from both parties have been talking about reforming the criminal justice system. Any life sentence in the Commonwealth is automatically life without parole, but Lieutenant Governor Fetterman has been trying to free some of those inmates. Any progress that he's made in this area?
Yeah, we've seen quite a change in this area. So Lieutenant Governor Fetterman is the chair of the Board of Pardons, which awards any form of clemency that could be a pardon or commutation. And commutation applies to these life sentences without the possibility of parole. Since the 80s, typically in a single year, you might see zero or one commutation awarded. But just in the last year, since Fetterman came into office, we've seen the board recommend 15 commutations. Governor Wolf has granted 6 of those, but it takes some time for him to reach that decision. And as governor, Wolf has awarded 11 commutations, which is a lot more than his predecessors since the 80s.
House members and senators on both sides of the aisle, they've been trying to overhaul the state's probation and parole systems as well. Some action was taken just this week, Katie. What did the House pass and send on to the Senate?
Sure. So this is a package of bills. Well, rather, it's part of a package of bills. I think we're seeing if they're going to finish it up. I think they will. Basically, the three bills in this package would create a parole advisory committee. So, hoping to help counties manage parole. Another one would expand compensation for crime victims. Third one would allow automatic parole for some low-level offenders. That's the key component. And so we did see the House pass that, but we saw them pass it with some controversial amendments. One of them would institute new mandatory minimum sentences for people who are convicted of harming minors. So the people who put that in, it's mostly Republicans, say that, they cast this as sort of an anti-child abuse thing. But, many Democrats and some Republicans as well say they really don't think mandatory minimums are good policy. They say they just, they make criminal justice more expensive. They don't necessarily kind of inhibit crime very much. And studies have borne that out. They've also shown that mandatory minimums are applied in a racially profiling way, mostly to black men. So a lot of discussion always comes up when mandatory minimums are introduced to bills. So, but that did pass, and we will see what the Senate does with it. I'm assuming in the new year. I don't think they're going to do it before then. There's been a lot of debate over this.
And finally, on Lee, a study from the American Civil Liberties Union found that the use of cash bail in Allegheny County dropped by about 9% between 2018 and early this year. They also found that too many people await trial behind bars because they can't afford to post the bail. So what kind of policies did the ACLU call for in this report, and have any been implemented?
Essentially, what the ACLU wants and has been pushing for quite a while is to end the use of money bail entirely. They say that it's unconstitutional because it means that people's freedom depends on their ability to pay bail. And this is before they've even gone to trial and been convicted or found innocent. So they say that that has really severe consequences for people who are taken from their families, from their communities, from their jobs. So they think this is a practice that needs to end, and that has not happened yet.
Anlie Herring is a reporter with WESA's Government Accountability Team. Katie Meyer is WESA's Capital Bureau Chief in Harrisburg. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The mayor and Pittsburgh School Board are battling over finances in the school district. The top education stories are next when the Confluence's Year in Review continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're looking back at the top news stories of the year. And when it comes to education, many of those reports focused on Pittsburgh public schools. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Welcome back to the program, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
The latest story with the school district came last night when the school board approved a $666 million budget. But the board rejected a proposed property tax hike. Sarah, was that surprising?
Yeah, definitely unprecedented. You know, the board solicitor, Ira Weiss, has been in education for 47 years, and he said he's never seen this because the board approved this $666 million budget with the tax increase. And then the next vote is for the tax increase, and they reject it. So right now, until the board figures this out, by the end of the year, it has to be done. We've got a big hole in the budget because a lot of funding comes from local property taxes.
About $27 million, was it?
No, that's overall
the
in
deficit?
The budget.
Okay.
The
okay.
deficit is $27 million, and they knew that going in.
So why was it proposed in the first place?
So a lot of what the district says, the administration says, costs outside of the district's control keep growing, even as the district is losing students. So charter school costs, the district has to pay charter schools that teach Pittsburgh students, and those costs are outpacing enrollment, and also retirement costs. You know, we have a lot of teachers that the district is paying into retirement, and those just skyrocket every year.
You reported in November the district has about $112 million in the bank. Mm-hmm. Is the board going to tap that, or do they have other alternatives?
So really, I mean, that money is set aside for many different purposes already. There's about $33 million what they call the reserve fund, and the district has a policy that 5% of the budget has to be set aside or else they're out of compliance. That could mean potentially state takeover at some point. So they want to remain with that money in that fund balance.
Right. You mentioned controllable or uncontrollable costs. Mm-hmm. One cost item that is controllable is travel expenses. Auditor General Eugene DePasquale ripped the district for a 179% increase in travel in the last 3 years. The Auditor General questioned whether these trips benefit students. How did Superintendent Hamlet respond?
Right. So that's about triple the amount that's been spent on travel since Superintendent Anthony Hamlet was hired, and he defended that. He said he was brought in to be this transformational leader to make sure that teachers had professional development, that the board knew what they were doing when they were, you know, passing different policies. So he's defended that. The board has defended that. They don't seem to be deterred by it.
Of course, Hamlet came under fire earlier this year for another unauthorized trip to Cuba. What came of that investigation?
So that was a trip that he took with some assistant superintendents. They went to Florida for professional development. They knew they were going to be in Florida. They said at the time they didn't know they were going to Cuba, even right. though they were told to take their passports. He told you on the Confluence that, you know, nothing nefarious happened there. But the school board president did approve this. It hasn't been talked about in public yet. They're referring to this as a personnel matter, so it hasn't been discussed publicly.
Hamlet and Mayor Peduto criticized each other over the district's finances. They met Monday. Anything get resolved?
So Superintendent Anthony Hamlet is hard to come by these days. He dodges the press pretty frequently. So he didn't speak to the media after that, and he did not speak to us last night after the school board meeting. But Bill Peduto did tell the Post-Gazette that, you know, it was a meeting to clear the air. He's really called out the school district for its spending, and he said that this was a chance for him to tell them that, you know, I'm going to help you, you know, maybe meet with foundations for additional funding. But he did say, you know, you're not getting that the wage tax back, which is what started this entire
right.
controversy.
And the district has some meetings planned to deal with a shrinking enrollment. Enrollment is also an issue for Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities. 112,000 students down to 90,000 over the last 8 years. What's this doing to the system?
Yeah, so the system says the same thing, that costs outside of their control are growing, and there is, you know, a $60 million shortfall when the system in they did freeze tuition this year for the first time in 20 years, saying that, you know, we're not going to rely on students to fill that shortfall, that the state really needs to step in and, you know, fund higher right. education in the way that the system says it should be.
Any hints of closing any of the 14?
No, not publicly, though. The chancellor of the state system did say, you know, when this happened in July, that a tuition freeze is not sustainable. You know, fundamental changes have to come.
Sarah Schneider is the education reporter at WESA. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Coming up, a look at major developments in the art scene. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to the Confluence's Year in Review on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There was some big movement within Pittsburgh art scene in 2019, and WESA reporter Bill O'Driscoll was there to cover it all. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Kevin.
Let's start backwards, if you will. In November, Pittsburgh Center for the Arts and Media announced that it laid off the majority of its staff and closed two art house movie theaters, the Harris Theater and the Regent Square, and then vacated the landmark Marshall Mansion. This came after a rebranding, which included a new name. So what happened?
Well, I think there's probably still some details to come out, but basically what the PCAM is saying is they didn't have the money to pay for the upkeep of some of these facilities, specifically the Marshall Mansion, which had long been in need of repairs and upgrades and things along those lines. Very expensive building to maintain. They don't own it. The city owns it, and they lease it for $1 a year, but they're responsible for the upkeep. So they're pulling back from that mansion, also vacating the Regent Square Theater, which they do own, and stopped programming the Harris Theater downtown, which the Cultural Trust owns. I should add that the Harris Theater is still running art house movies. The Cultural Trust is doing that. They're using some of PCAM's old staff, so that theater is still operating. Fate of the Regent Square remains up in the air. The Marshall Mansion, that big yellow building on Fifth Avenue, is going to be empty come year's end. Big loss for the local visual arts community. A lot of gallery space for local artists there that will no longer be programmed.
Mm-hmm. Not the only arts organization to close its doors. The Arts Institute abruptly called it quits in the spring. Looking back, what impact has that had?
Well, they're a major educational institution here for decades and decades. Had always been the subject of some controversy over the years, you know, the quality of the education there and so forth. But, you know, definitely a loss for the local scene, local economy, opportunities for people. Certainly some people did have great experiences there, and that's just not going to be there anymore.
Mm. On the flip side, the Roxian Theater in McKees Rocks reopened this year after sitting empty for 16 years. When it first opened its doors in 1929, it was a vaudeville theater. The space now serves as a medium-sized concert venue. What kind of acts has it been able to draw?
Well, it gets these kind of mid-range touring acts that had often bypassed Pittsburgh or been in venues that were either too small or too large for them. It was long thought that Pittsburgh was missing this kind of 1,500-seat theater that was appropriate for concerts. Really a beautiful renovation there, historically sensitive. The sound is good in there. The guy that owns it, or he's the majority owner named John Pergel, also owns the Thunderbird Cafe in Lawrenceville, which also reopened with a big new renovation. These were both big things in the local music scene, two essentially new venues for touring bands and even local bands to play at.
I know it's early, but so far, how have patrons been responding? Are they going there?
Pretty good, yeah. Generally, I've been to a show or two at each of those places. People seem to like them. I mean, it's great to have sort of a new place to go. And it's, from what I hear, they've been drawing pretty well.
Over the summer, Pittsburghers were surprised to learn that there would not be a regatta in 2019. Cancellation came with little warning. Remind us, what happened?
Yeah, real suddenly, we were informed that the people who put on the regatta were not paying their bills, and perhaps most unwisely, they were not paying the police for overtime officers, generally not folks that you want to not pay your bills. So the permits were withdrawn, and the regatta did not happen. It was announced like just days before it was supposed to happen, so Point State Park sat quiet that weekend.
Right. And I know we're months and months away, but is there any indication that there might be a regatta in 2020?
Haven't heard anything yet. One would hope. I mean, the regatta has gone through numerous iterations over the years. I'm pretty sure there were a couple years back in the 90s or early 2000s where it didn't happen also. So we'll see. I mean, it would be a bit of a hole in the summer without it.
Poet Toy Derricotte released a collection that was nominated for a National Book Award. The book launch was held in Pittsburgh's North Side, and Very Smart Brothers founder Damon Young got national attention for his memoir. Were the two biggest releases from Pittsburgh this year, were they?
I think so. In terms of general buzz, Toy's book was the poetry, her kind of a retrospective, but also some new work, very well reviewed. She's very well respected in the national scene, nominated for the National Book Award. Damon, known mostly as a blogger, but did this wonderful memoir called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. Very funny, very heartfelt, very vulnerable. Got a lot of great reviews and attention nationally. I think he's up for an award now, too. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, those were definitely two of the big ones that came out of Pittsburgh.
And definitely reflecting well on Pittsburgh.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So, Bill, what are you most looking forward to in 2020?
Well, there's a couple things happening early in the year. I mean, I won't go too far into the year, but the Carnegie Museum of Art is doing this show called Counter Pressure, which is local artists looking at the urgent need to address climate change. That opens in February. That's a big one. Pittsburgh Public Theater is opening a play called American Son, which deals with race and police violence. That opens in March. Those are a couple pretty big ones that are coming up in the next couple months.
So your brief general assessment, how's the art scene doing in Pittsburgh?
I don't know. It's been a tumultuous year for sure. There's a lot of leadership shakeups. The Kelly Strayhorn, Janera Solomon, who's been a longtime leader, not only at the theater, but the local arts community, is leaving there at the end of the year. We'll see who replaces her. But, I think generally it's pretty good, but it's always in flux. And, the Center for Arts and Media pullback, their kind of downsizing is really a loss.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The Confluence is taking several days off for the holidays, but we'll be working on new shows for 2020. If you have suggestions for topics or perspectives you want to hear in the coming year, email our full team at confluence@wesa.fm. You can also tune into WESA's 43rd Annual Christmas Request Show. Please tune in tomorrow from noon to 4. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.